From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Haunted Cemetery in Barbados. At night, the moon shimmers over the silver Caribbean and lights up the ornate coral and stone crypt that stands on a headland of the lovely West Indian island of Barbados. It is, or was, a family crypt, and rests in the parish churchyard near the sea, in the town of Christchurch. The entrance to the crypt, partially hewn out of the flinty rock, was once sealed by a massive stone slab. In times gone by, each time a new coffin was placed inside the vault, a gang of at least half a dozen strong men was needed to move the slab inside. In this crypt, for a period of 13 years, from 1807 to 1820, there occurred periodic morbid happenings that still defy any natural or scientific explanation. The crypt was the property of Colonel Thomas Chase, a well-to-do Englishman who made his home on Barbados. The peaceful island, continually swept by trade winds, had been occupied by the British as early as 1627. In the minds of many Barbadians, the supernatural occurrences in the crypt were linked with the character of Colonel Chase himself. He was known to be a cruel man with an ungovernable temper, a harsh parent, and a slave owner who ill-treated his charges. Having acquired the crypt early in the new century, Chase did not have occasion to use it until July 31, 1807. At that time, a Mrs. Goddard, a member of the family, died. When the crypt was opened to receive her heavy lead coffin, it was quite empty. Several months later, in 1808, Mariana Chase, the colonel's infant daughter, died of disease. The crypt was opened again, and Mrs. Goddard's coffin was seen in its proper place. 4 years passed, and then Dorcas Chase, an older daughter of the colonel's, died. On July 6, 1812, when her casket was placed in the crypt, the first two coffins were precisely as they should have been. A month after Dorcas was entombed, Colonel Chase himself suddenly died. When the gang of workmen removed the slab to place their master's coffin in the crypt, they and members of the Chase family were shocked at what they saw inside. The coffins of Mrs. Goddard, Mariana, and Dorcas were discovered in a jumbled state. They had apparently been thrown about like so many sticks of wood. The position of the infant's small casket was the strangest of all. It had been moved or thrown diagonally from the corner where it originally lay to the opposite corner of the tomb. Before the tomb was resealed with the colonel's body in it, the disturbed coffins were replaced in their proper positions, that is, three on the floor side by side and the other laid on top of them. And this time someone thought to strew the crypt floor with a thin layer of sand for the purpose of detecting the footprints of possible intruders. 4 years later, in September 1816, another infant family member's body was made ready for burial in the Chase crypt. When the stone slab was pushed aside, the astonished family again found great disorder among the leaden caskets. All four were scattered about, as if some crazed giant had been let loose inside the vault. Indeed, it would have taken a giant to do the job, for it took at least four men to lift just one of the adult coffins. It was also discovered that the layer of fine white sand on the crypt floor was undisturbed by footprints or markings of any kind. Just a few weeks later, the body of another family member, Samuel Brewster, was taken from the parish of St. Philip and reinterred in the Chase vault. Again, the heavy coffins were found scattered about willy-nilly at odd angles. Again, too, there was the fine sand on the floor, with no markings to be seen in it. Mystified, the family attending Brewster's interment watched the sweating, grunting workmen as they struggled to replace the coffins in their proper positions. Three side by side on the floor, and the others laid on top of them. When the gang of men had slid the great stone slab back in place, Mason stepped forward to seal up the crypt again with mortar. After this most recent disturbance of the crypt's coffins, the islanders of Barbados began to mutter and speculate. What or who was perpetrating these ghoulish acts? Various theories went the rounds, but none seemed plausible. Had sea water somehow penetrated the crypt and shifted the casket about? But how could sea water rise through the solid coral and rock to where the churchyard sat, 100 feet above sea level? Volcanic activity could be pretty well ruled out, since only the coffins were moved. A force strong enough to do that would certainly have damaged the close-fitting masonry work of the vault, but the blocks were intact and undisturbed. In addition, the approaches to the crypt were so clearly out in the open that any vandals or pranksters would be easily seen. Even if it were possible for such persons to remove the stone slabs and enter the vault, the feat of dislodging the heavy coffins would have required several men who would have been quickly discovered by the rector or sexton of the churchyard. Yet all such speculation seemed silly, for the mortar sealed up the entrance had not been broken or tampered with in any way. Even so, stories of the haunted crypt and its restless dead sent shivers of apprehension through the islanders. While they would not go near the churchyard at night, dozens of Barbadians flocked within gazing distance of the crypt by day. They would point and whisper about the doobies as specters and evil spirits were called on the island. There were other murky rumors circulating among the populace. It was whispered that Dorcas Chase had slowly starved herself to death because of her father's cruelty toward her. In addition, some believed that Colonel Chase had died by his own hand, perhaps out of remorse for causing his daughter's death. After all, the two had been interred in the crypt within a month of each other. It was also generally assumed by everyone that, since the disturbances had dated from Colonel Chase's burial, he must be unwelcome there, and someone or something had made a violent effort to expel him. At any rate, in the next few years, the energetic governor of Barbados, Lord Combermere, became increasingly concerned about the alarm these rumors were causing. Combermere determined to seize the first opportunity to investigate the matter and get to the bottom of it. He knew, too, that the Chase family wished to have the affair cleared up officially. His chance came in early July of 1819, when the next death occurred in the family. The body of Thomasina Clark was placed in its leaden casket, and the crypt opened to receive it. Lord Combermere was on hand with officials of his staff when, for the fourth time, the coffins were discovered in great disarray. Lord Combermere's wife wrote in her journal, "In my husband's presence, every part of the floor was sounded to ascertain that no subterranean passage or entrance was concealed. It was found to be perfectly firm and solid. No crack was even apparent. The walls, when examined, proved to be perfectly secure. No fracture was visible, and the sides, together with the roof and flooring, presented a structure so solid as if formed of entire slabs of stone. The displaced coffins were rearranged, the new tenant of that dreary abode was deposited, and when the mourners retired with the funeral procession, the floor was sanded with fine white sand in the presence of Lord Combermere and the assembled crowd. The door was slid into its wonted position, and with the utmost care, the new mortar was laid on so as to secure it. When the masons had completed their task, the governor made several impressions in the mixture with his own seal, and many of those attending added various private marks in the wet mortar. From that moment on, the whole island seethed with speculation about what the next opening of the new notorious crypt might reveal. The islanders were boiling with excitement, and they found the waiting hard. At length, after the crypt had remained sealed for 9 months, Combermere agreed to the vaults being unsealed on April 18th, 1820. It was the big event of the year. Entire towns turned out as if it were a public holiday, which in fact the event had become. Islanders by the hundreds surged towards the brow of the hill above Christchurch to gape in anticipation at the celebrated crypt in the churchyard. There they awaited in hushed silence and superstitious awe for the arrival of the governor. Excited murmurs whipped through the crowds when at last Lord Combermere made his appearance. The nobleman first examined the vault, satisfying himself that all was as it had been at the ceiling 9 months before. The mortar was unbroken, and the impressions of his official seal were etched as sharply as the day they had been made. Each man who had made his private mark also satisfied himself that it was unaltered. Lord Combermere then commanded the workmen to break the official seal. The masonry yielded as usual to their tools, but when several workmen tried to move the great stone slab, it resisted their efforts. Even when greater force was applied, the stone could not be budged. The onlookers were beside themselves with suspense. Looks of wondering dismay passed from one islander to the next, but only for a short while. As if their combined energy and anticipation gave inspired strength to the workman's effort, the slab moved about an inch. Additional men were ordered to help, and inch by inch the stone was slid aside until there was sufficient space to enter. The governor and others were dumbfounded when they discovered why the slab had been almost impossible to move. One of the leaden coffins was standing on end with its other end resting solidly against the stone slab. How this heavy object had come to rest in this remarkable position was a mystery, for the fine sand on the crypt floor bore no footprints, nor was it in any way disturbed. The other coffins were confusedly tossed about the tomb, some with their heads down and others up. The casket of one of the infants had been hurled with such force against one of the crypt walls that a deep dent had been made in the stone where one corner had struck. Another leaden casket had been flung down the steps which led to the bottom of the crypt. Horrified, the Chase family gave orders for all the caskets to be removed at once from the crypt and buried in graves elsewhere. After this, the vault was abandoned and was never again used as a burial place. While the mysterious Barbados crypt case has been proved by several investigators, no one has yet come up with a satisfactory explanation of the occurrences there. Indeed, some theories seem more preposterous than the events they purported to clarify. Vandalism, voodooism, the restless spirit of Dorcas Chase avenging itself on her father? Above all, who or what was the powerful and enigmatic force that lifted the heavy leaden coffin and propped it feet up against the crypt's stone slab? The Fortune Cookie Poltergeist, a true story from China. In the teeming British Crown Colony of Hong Kong, shortly before World War II, there occurred a case of poltergeist activity with a very unusual aspect. The locale was a popular Chinese restaurant called the Dragon's Claw. It was one of hundreds in the busy pre-war metropolis, but like many others, it did not survive the long Japanese occupation of the 1940s. The owner of the Dragon's Claw was a man in his early 60s named Ah Fong. Ah Fong had done well with his restaurant for several years. His location was a good one in the center of the city, and he made sure that the ingredients in his dishes were of the best quality. In addition, he paid his cooks well, and consequently, he had his pick of the finest ones to be had. Because of his insistence on culinary excellence, Ah Fong attracted a good clientele in Hong Kong. Among his customers, he served many British officers stationed in the colony, and also American and European businessmen who frequently visited the city and nearby Kowloon. Unlike many Hong Kong restaurateurs, Ah Fong had learned of the popularity in American Chinese establishments of fortune cookies containing cheery or prophetic messages. So, he had instituted the practice at the Dragon's Claw. Not only did foreigners enjoy reading and laughing over their sentiments on the little slips of paper, but so did his native Chinese clientele. In the summer of 1937, Afong expanded his restaurant by purchasing an old building in the rear of the property. With the increase in the number of tables, he had to hire a few more waiters to serve them. One of these was 15-year-old lad named Qin Luk, who, dissatisfied with his life as a rural laborer in central China, had come to Hong Kong to find work. Qin Luk had told Afong that he wanted to become a cook, the finest in China if he could, and begged to be assigned as a kitchen apprentice. Afong said that his kitchen staff was full. Perhaps if a vacancy occurred in the future, he would give Qin Luk a chance. So disappointed, but still glad to have a job, Qin Luk went to work as a waiter at the Dragon's Claw. His employer advised him to learn some English as soon as he could, for he would be serving many British and American customers. Qin Luk nodded and said that he would. And he did. Afong kept a rather fatherly eye on him. He observed the young Qin Luk was soon able to converse effectively with the British Army and naval officers who dropped into the restaurant, and that he could also understand and feel the orders of the drawling American businessmen. Yet at times Afong detected a look of discontent, even resentment, on the young waiter's face. The foreigners were always crisply and elegantly dressed, had plenty of money to spend, and sometimes treated the Chinese waiters as inferiors. All this Afong saw and understood, for he had once been a waiter himself. The disturbances began after Qin Luk had been on the job for 6 months. One evening in the serving area where the steaming food was assembled for individual guests, a metal cover from a dish of fried rice was seen to rise in the air. It sailed along for about 6 feet, then dropped to the carpet beside a customer's table. Nobody saw this event except a couple of mystified waiters, one of whom was Qin Luk. The metal top was retrieved and nothing else happened on this occasion. 3 nights later, a stack of crockery in the kitchen toppled over for no reason that anyone could see and smashed on the floor. About a week later, near midnight when the last customer had left, 4 waiters and Afong himself saw a bundle of new chopsticks take off from a serving table and fly for some 15 feet out into the dining area. They dropped with a loud cracking noise just short of the bar. The waiters, including Qin Luk, began to chatter about the strange events. They asked Afong what it all meant. Afong, who was an avid reader, shrugged and shook his head. He had, he said, read of such things, but he had never seen them before. He told his employees not to worry, to carry on with their work. If anyone saw anything else of an odd nature, he should report it to him immediately. Up to this point, none of the poltergeist activity had affected or been noticed by the events. But in the next weeks, this was to change. In the first such event, Qin Luk was carrying an uncovered dish of shrimp and beef sprouts to a table occupied by a British major and his wife. When he was still 3 or 4 feet from their table, Afong and a waiter beside him saw the dish leap off Qin Luk's tray, overturn on the major's arm, and drop to the floor. Surprised and then furious, the major leaped up, brushing the food from his uniform and calling Qin Luk a clumsy oaf. Afong rushed over the napkin and helped clean the major up, apologizing profusely for the unfortunate accident. Qin Luk also assisted and said several times he was sorry. Finally, the major calmed down and the incident was soon forgotten by the couple. Later, Qin Luk, when questioned by his employer, denied any knowledge of why the dish had flown off the tray as it had. Fresh incidents now began to occur in the presence of guests, at least one every 2 or 3 days. Once a bottle of soy sauce elevated itself from the table of 3 astonished patrons and spilled all over the tablecloth. Qin Luk, whose table it was, came quickly with a cloth and cleaned it up. Another time, as he was picking up a cocktail from the bar, he and the bartender were amazed to see a wine bottle leave its rack above them and crash to the floor. One night, the top to a metal tureen of shark's fin soup became airborne, sailed 5 or 6 feet through the air, and struck a patron's leg. Chin Look apologized and retrieved the chewing top, for it occurred at his table. Then began the poltergeist activity involving the fortune cookies, which lasted just 1 week. The cookies were made on the premises of the Dragon's Claw by one of the cooks who doubled as a baker. Suddenly, at the beginning of this week, several of the patrons began complaining to their waiters about the way the cookies tasted. Some guests, when biting into them, discovered they contained blobs of hot Chinese mustard. Others complained they were filled with black pepper. This, Ah Feng noted, appeared most frequently at the table in Chin Look Station, although other waiters were getting the same complaints. After 2 days of this, Ah Feng summoned the baker and asked him frankly whether he had been stuffing the fortune cookies with the condiments. The man denied it vigorously. He had been making his batches as usual, cutting up the dough, then twisting the pieces up into individual cookies, before sliding them into the oven. True, he sometimes left a batch unattended before doing the twisting process, and somebody could have tampered with it, but he doubted it. At any rate, this ended the first phase of the fortune cookie incidents. During the middle of the week, the fortune cookies took to the air. In the kitchen, cookies in groups of 3 or 4 were seen to arise from their cookie tins and fly for several feet through the air before dropping to the floor. Out in the dining room, particularly at Chin Look Station, baskets of the fortune cookies left waiters' trays, flew for short distances, and tumbled to the floor. Other cookies rose individually or in pairs from patrons' tables, became briefly airborne, and scattered to the carpet. Ah Feng was standing in the vestibule one evening, surveying his clientele, when he saw 3 fortune cookies sail toward him menacingly and then drop noiselessly at his feet. By Friday of that final week, Ah Feng was worried. All of the flights of the fortune cookies had apparently ended, and all was momentarily in order. Customers were beginning to ask him what was wrong at the Dragon's Claw. Was the place haunted or jinxed or what? Some of his oldest Oriental patrons were suggesting that ancestral gods might be displeased for some reason. Furthermore, business was starting to fall off noticeably. The climax of the fortune cookie affair came during the evening meal on Sunday. Actually, nothing of a spectacular nature occurred to alarm the diners as they enjoyed the restaurant's fine cuisine. But around 9:30, Ah Feng, who was keeping an eagle eye on his patrons, saw a British rear admiral rise from his table and walk toward him. He was shaking his head. The admiral showed him a slip of paper he had found in one of his fortune cookies. On it was crudely scrawled in English, "British, get out of China." It was written in pencil and all the letters were lower case. The admiral was nice about the slur and even joked about it. Ah Feng expressed his regret and said he would investigate. He took the matter seriously. The last thing he wanted, especially for his business, was to stir up resentment between the British and the Chinese. Ah Feng also noted that the admiral's table was in Chin Look Station. First, Ah Feng called the baker to his office. He showed the man the slip of paper and asked if he knew how he could have gotten into the fortune cookie. The baker said he had no idea. Besides, he pointed out, the slips he put in the cookies were printed once, not handwritten. He kept a basket of them handy and inserted one as he twisted up each cookie. He never read them. He hardly looked at them as he performed this operation. He supposed anyone could have put the offending slip in his basket. Satisfied, Ah Feng dismissed the baker. Next, Ah Feng obtained samples of each waiter's handwriting. This was readily available from the food orders they took. He compared each man's handwriting with the crude writing on the slip in the admiral's fortune cookie. He paid particular attention to Chin Look's handwriting, but he could find no satisfactory evidence. All of the waiters wrote in rather crude English, frequently leaving out capital letters. Now Ah Feng knew little or nothing about psychic investigations. Indeed, that science was still in its infancy, but he wasn't blind either. From all that he had seen in the past weeks, it was obvious that somehow the presence of Chinlook had something to do with the disturbances at the Dragon's Claw. He did not want to dismiss the boy out of hand, for he had become fond of him. He decided to try an experiment. Summoning Chinlook, he said candidly that he was very worried about the recent odd happenings. They were bad for business, he said, and he suspected that in some way that no one understood, Chinlook was at the root of them. There was nothing dishonorable in this, he said kindly. Perhaps, he told the boy, something was bothering him that he was not consciously aware of. Who could understand such things? So Alphonse told the boy that he wished him to return home for 2 months. He had been working very hard, and a vacation would do him good. He would, he added, keep him on half pay during his absence. When he returned, Alphonse promised a place would be found for him as a cook's apprentice. Chinlook was overjoyed and left the next day. With his departure, the disturbances ceased altogether. When Chinlook returned and happily started his new job in the kitchen, they did not recommence. The case of poltergeist activity centering around the teenaged Chinlook is not so much remarkable for the flying objects involved, as in similar cases the boy, evidently upset in some way, had bottled up a great deal of psychokinetic or PK energy, which when subconsciously released manifested these events. It may even have accounted somehow for the condiments finding their way into the fortune cookies when the baker's back was turned. The usual aspect of the case lies in the mystery of how much energy could have produced the writing, however crude, on the slip of paper found in the fortune cookie.